Good afternoon. Please take your seats. The chair now calls this ALA Council Executive Board Membership Information Session to order. This meeting is held in accordance with policy A.4.2.5.2, which calls for at least one session of the ALA Council to be held with the Executive Board prior to the regular meetings of Council. Any member of the association may participate in the information session. This is an information session only. No action may be taken here. It is ALA's policy to employ a professional parliamentarian for all of its business meetings at annual conferences. It is my pleasure to introduce Ellie Mina, ALA's parliamentarian. Also on the platform today are Barbara K. Stripling, ALA President-elect, Keith Michael Field. Yes, we should applaud Barbara. Keith Michael Fields, ALA Executive Director and Secretary to Council. Joanne Kempf, Director of the ALA Office of Governance. I would also like to introduce Danielle Alderson, our projectionist, and Lois Ann Gregory Wood, our Council Secretariat. This meeting is being captioned for the hearing impaired. Our captionist for this annual conference is Heather Theriak. If you wish to take advantage of this service, please be seated where you can see the screens. Today's agenda, ALA Council Document 8.4, revised on June 28, 2013 at 10:10 p.m., is available at the Council Documents pickup station in the back of the room. I am now pleased to present my president's report, which is ALA Council Document 21.1. You have this report. I've had the opportunity this year through my columns in American Libraries to keep the membership apprised of what it is that I have been doing and the important initiatives for the association. So I'll just highlight briefly a couple of them. The first is the work that we've been able to do building upon immediate past President Molly Raphael's leadership with civic engagement to really advance our work in the area of community engagement. We're well on our way in the partnership with the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation to create a set of tools, techniques, and approaches for people to use at the local level to engage their communities on whatever issues are going to be important and will be chosen by those communities. We're about to convene our first leadership, and we're calling it Leading for the Future, Leadership Institute for librarians across different types of libraries. This will be held in August. And then the other aspect of leadership development is we're going to convene a second offering of leadership in a digital age. And I'm particularly pleased with the work that has been done in the divisions, in many of ALA's offices, at the leadership level, the executive level among staff, also the board, with what I'm now calling, and many of us are calling, reimagining ALA as an association. This has been a year in which I've had more opportunities than I would have imagined to represent the association internationally, but also on the national scene. We are at a time when many more people in government and in the media recognize the importance of libraries in a whole variety of issues and initiatives. And each of us should take pride in the work that all of us have done to bring us to that point. So at this point, I'll just stop and invite questions that any of you may have about the report. And hearing or seeing no indication of questions, let us proceed to the next agenda item. I now direct your attention to ALA Council Document 29.1 and call upon ALA President-elect Barbara K. Stripling to present her report. Barbara?
Hello. I would like to highlight just a few things of the year forward rather than what I did in the past year, which was to prepare for the year forward. The first thing I would like to highlight is a declaration for the right to libraries. I hope that you have encountered this. I tried to send it out to council beforehand so that you could look at it and see and digest it and get your minds around it. There is a copy of the declaration on the back table. We're running out of signature room, but don't worry, we have more signature sheets that we will bring to the next council session. Our plan is to have a national signing campaign where our public members, our legislators, our mayors, students, parents, community members can affirm their right to good, strong, effective libraries of all types in their community. And that local libraries of all types can hold a signing campaign, a signing celebration, where you can actually celebrate, invite your community to come in and celebrate the library. I think it's going to be a way that we can do active advocacy that enables people to stand up and speak. A second area of my Libraries Change Lives initiative is literacy, and there are going to be several pieces of that, but I wanted to tell you that one of the first things we did was to reach out to Michelle Washington, the new literacy officer, and so we'll be working together to bring together a lot of the things that are happening throughout ALA on literacy and to highlight those. A third one is innovation, and we all know that we have a lot of innovative practices and we don't necessarily share them. One of the things that we are going to do to help share is that we're developing a coordination with TEDx, and we're going to facilitate libraries creating TEDx videos and using TEDx in their communities for community conversation. The final strand is community engagement, and I just want to commit to you that we will continue the push of the promise of libraries transforming community, building a partnership with Harwood Institute, and really spread this throughout the country, provide the kind of support that you need in order to engage in this really important work of putting our libraries at the center of our community priorities. The continuing initiatives, we will definitely continue them, and I think all of you all would just stand up and shout for the work that the Digital Content Working Group has done, and I assure you that I will continue every bit of support that I can for that really important work. And finally, I just wanted to mention that a huge piece of what ALA will be engaged in this year is an advocacy campaign for school libraries. I know that all of you all are aware. I know that all of you all are aware that it is a critical point. We are an ecosystem of libraries. Every library depends on another type of library, and if we're going to have a vibrant system, we need all types of libraries working together. We're developing a campaign. We have an implementation task force. We welcome your ideas, your input, and your active voice in support of school libraries. And I'm open for questions.
Are there questions for Barbara? Microphone 4.
Liz Bischoff. Liz Bischoff asked, Counselor, Barbara, this is really exciting. When do you expect to kick off the Declaration for Libraries signature campaign initiative?
Thank you for the question. We have actually two things already planned. One is that I'm going to the Nashville area to speak at the Nashville Public Library. And they have the Nashville Public Library has a joint professional development with school librarians. It's at either the end of July or the 1st of August. I don't know. I'm a little confused when I'm going where. but we're going to do a huge media kickoff to the campaign there, because we're hoping Larry Romans from Vanderbilt comes, that it's a whole, all types of libraries together to kick that off. A second piece that we've already planned is that in October, we're hoping to have a school library week where the national campaign for signatures starts in school libraries across the country in the same week. So it's a big splash that we're starting here and then pushing out to other types of libraries. It doesn't really mean we have to start there, but we're starting a huge media push there. I think it will both kickstart the declaration and kickstart the school library campaign and bring it together. So those are the two things we have planned right now to kick it off.
Microphone three.
Bernie Margolis, Councilor at Large, thank you for your great report, and the initiative of a declaration, I think, is a fantastic idea.
Thank you.
I am concerned, however, because as I read the popular press, the Pew studies and others, our results are pretty mixed. Some people love us, some people love us a lot, some people use us, some people don't use us, think we're important, and don't use us, and don't think we're important. It's a mixed bag, but it's a bag that I think has some ominous sort of clouds in the sky in terms of the future of libraries of every sort. So I'm wondering whether there is the wherewithal and the resource commitment within ALA to do some bold things to get our reputation, to get our importance, to get our significance in play. And I mean interviewing, you know, the top three or four PR firms in the country, finding out what they would charge us to really do, you said reinvention, Maureen, I think, or reimagining.
Reimagining.
How do we get professionals? If we wanted information, we go to librarians. If we want good PR work, we should go to PR professionals. How do we at least beg for some help to begin with, find out what a real initiative would cost, and then go to our corporate partners and others and say, here's the tab, let's raise some money, because if we don't, we may be important public institutions, and we may be able to engage in civic discourse with our neighbors and our other anchor organizations, but we will be marginalized. We will be pushed to the side. So I think the time, I hope, to sort of hitch something to your declaration would be now. And I'd be certainly happy to volunteer my time and effort to help with this. I think we have to do this. I think we really are losing ground in terms of the public context. You know, when we're sort of joked about on late night television, you know the cliff isn't too far off. And I think we have the wherewithal. I'm not sure we have the financial resources, but I think that will come if we have a good plan, a good initiative, if the idea of reimagining catches fire with others who benefit from a strong library community. So I want to urge you to sort of expand the declaration idea to some other initiatives. Thank you.
I would have a couple of responses. Thank you, Bernie. I always listen to you. I agree. Libraries are at a critical point, and this is our time to stand up and be counted. Patty brought me a list. We already have in place a plan to reach out to organizations way beyond libraries, and we have a list of, I don't know, 20, 30 people, people like the Benton Foundation, Easter Seals, National Asian Pacific Center on Aging, Pro-Literacy, Senior Service America. These are people who have already signed the declaration. And so this is our opportunity to not just call on ALA resources or librarians, but we really need to network and pull in all of those resources that are out there, people who recognize that they have a stake in strong libraries, and that is part of what we are planning.
Microphone four.
Stephanie Bronstein, counselor from Louisiana Library Association. My question really is having to do with individual chapters doing their own signing process.
Yes.
I'm hoping that soon we'll be able to get information on how to do that,
yes.
And maybe some packets or whatever we'll need. But this is maybe a silly question, but, you know, I have to have the answer. I've just signed the one back here.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that Louisiana does our own. Do I get to sign it again?
That's actually a pretty good question, and I've already violated what I think is the answer. I've already signed two. We are going to count, and it is important that we also have location because we're going to try to track the numbers by location so we can see the flow. It is probably better that we don't sign two, but I'm not going to quibble. And to me, it was important to sign both of the big petitions that came out. I would think a library director would want to sign. If you have them all at the same event, then you don't need to. But if it's going out, you need to stand up for it. So we're not going to quibble. Yeah.
Microphone four.
Tom Wilding, personal member. Barbara, will there be a virtual element to this as well?
We deliberated that. Initially, we thought it would be largely virtual because that would be easier. And then someone who's done a similar campaign said there is so much value to the physical signing and bringing people together and the conversation around it. So we're going to have a combination. And ALA is going to help us work on a way to do virtual signing, but we are also going to send declarations out to each state and have physical signing, and we already have declarations up on the ALA website for downloading, and anyone can get signatures.
Good. I think that there are large parts of the country where it's so rural and people are so dispersed that trying to get physical signatures might not work, but virtual would.
Yes, I recognize that.
Microphone two.
Walter Betts, Texas Library Association counselor. Will there be a push to have President Obama sign one?
To have, oh, yes.
President Obama.
Yes, and I have just a couple of cards in the back of my head that we'll play. Yes.
Microphone three.
Christine Lind, Hague PLA counselor, and we just discussed this at our PLA board, and they endorsed it. So how do you want divisions to sign on?
Yes, just as we're collecting organization signatures, we would like divisions within ALA roundtables and then individuals on top of that. I think there's merit to having both. So I'll hand you the, I don't know. I don't know yet. We'll figure it out.
Thank you, Barbara.
Yeah.
I now refer you to ALA Council Document 23.1 and ask Keith Michael Fields, ALA Executive Director, and the Secretary of Council to present his report.
You have document 12.3.4. I'm just going to highlight a few things, and I'm very lucky, actually, because Barbara and Maureen have done most of my work for me. Just to add a couple of things on digital content, I think that one of the things that we're very pleased with is that the dialogue that began, almost 2 years ago by President Molly Raphael with the publishers has certainly over the course of the last month or so really produced some fine results, in that at this point all of the big five publishers now are currently engaged in library pilots. So I think that's a tremendous step forward, and want to thank Molly and Maureen for leading that effort. And so let's say that all of those publishers are selling ebooks to libraries, then our work is done. Our work is not done, of course. The Digital Content Working Group, which has been a fabulous effort that really came from a council initiative, is currently working in a number of areas, and they include accessibility, they include digital preservation, and also, very practically, they include beginning to work on things like can we make ownership of ebooks, real ownership of ebooks, and can we get the prices to the point where they're not punishing to to libraries and libraries patrons. So stay tuned, because that group will be working over the course of the coming year. On the school library, one of the things that the legislative committee will be talking about on Tuesday when they report back is that we've had a very encouraging development in that ESEA authorization has been introduced in the Senate, and that does contain a provision for school libraries and school library service. So that is an enormous, just getting a flag on the ground in the reauthorization of ESEA is critical. It is extremely unlikely, and I sound like Emily when I say this, that the House will follow suit on this. So we have a huge battle before us. This is the struggle of our lifetime. We have to, and I think the declaration is part of this, we have to actually prevail on this, because a whole generation of students is really dependent on this. So whether this takes a year or whether it takes 10 years, we have to stay at this. We absolutely must prevail, because it's going to be one of the most important endeavors that we're going to be involved in our lives. Other news that I want to just share with you, we did have our a virtual membership meeting on June 6th, and had 400 members from around the world join us for a session with Maureen and Barbara, myself, and Jim Neal, and that we got very good feedback on that. So we're very pleased that for the many members who can't attend in the flesh, the virtual membership meeting does seem to really be catching on, and was very successful. Two other announcements, and those have to do with the fact that this year we're going to be awarding the second Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction and Nonfiction. It's a new adult book award. Has been getting, last year I think we got something like, you know, 15,000 mentions in the national press. It's a great opportunity to highlight to the public the important role that librarians play in promoting literature and promoting authors and all of that. Also, as Maureen indicated at the opening session, that we have been approved for another 2 years of the New York Times I Love My Librarian Award. So there's been some real good news. I want to just also, for those of you that are curious, we're looking at a real successful Chicago conference, just based on what you can see out in the corridors there. We have 439 programs and 984 meetings scheduled, with a total of 2,792 programs, meetings, special events, receptions, author sessions, stages on the exhibit floor, reunions, poster sessions, pre-cons, exhibitor events, ticketed events, and, you know, bar meetings. No, I just added that last one to see if everyone was paying attention. Those are just a couple of highlights. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Keith? Go to the mic. I'm about to call upon microphone three.
Mayor Bibelow, Councilor at large, I want to say this much. This is a we received a memo from Keith Fields talking about there would be no more petitioned candidates by paper. And I wonder what was the rationale behind that, because I am one who is very concerned about people being nominated by petition candidates on paper, because I feel this has a way of contacting new people and encouraging those who are a bit hesitant about running for council, and by signing petitions. Therefore, I would like for you to elaborate on why you made this decision and put it into effect so quickly. We should have had a little waiting period. I know you stated in your memo that 75% are online now and about 25 or 30 by petition. However, I do believe you're taking a bit advantage of us who do wish to use the paper petition.
The rationale to go with online is consistent with your people are going to see a large push across the association. Most of the divisions at this point have either gone paperless or are in the process of going paperless. The advantages of that obviously run from the environmental impact, but also the fact that with the availability of technology, there's a lot of pressure within the organization on the part of people because dealing with electronic documents is ultimately easier. The only thing we have, as I indicated in my memo, is that we are prepared to offer any assistance to anyone who would like help in preparing an online petition and would encourage any of you who are aware of anyone who has any interest, because normally they would approach you. That's how they would get a paper form. Just help them to get over, and Danielle, Lois Ann will help them get set up so that they can file an online petition. It's very easy.
Okay, several people have come up to me and said, well, how do you sign a petition online? These things haven't even been discussed with us as a body. And it's true, that things are going online, but we are still here, existing in this present time, and I do think that we should be given a timely consideration before you take such an action.
Right.
Microphone 4.
Elizabeth Riddler, Counselor at Large. One comment and one question. Keith and everybody else, I was so pleased to see that the WIPO treaty passed with the exemption for print disabilities, because I had heard that there'd been a lot of pushback and politicking. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's been something I've been pushing now for 3 or 4 years with the Ledge Committee and so on, and I'm just thrilled. Thank you.
Thank you. Microphone 3.
I didn't finish.
Oops, I'm sorry.
And also, I was going to ask Keith, he gave us the number of programs and so on. It would be good if you could also give us attendance figures currently known.
The attendance figures, yeah, I was saving that for the end, but I do have it right here. Attendance as of, this is the end of the day on Friday, was a grand total of 13,950 registrants and 5,700 vendors for a grand total of 19,677 people, and that compares with Anaheim, which at this point was 15,550. So we're about to crack 20,000, and I do understand that we've got about 3,000 exhibit-only passes that we're expecting to see today and tomorrow.
Thank you. Microphone 3.
Al Kagan, CERT Counselor. Keith, you've been so forthcoming on so many things over the years. Recently, I think one or 2 weeks ago, I asked if you could get us a report from the Washington office on what they're doing about lobbying on the abuse of Section 215 of the Patriot Act related to the recent revelations from Ed Snowden. And I wondered if we're going to see that report at the council.
Al, I was under the impression in my report, I briefly discussed it in my report, which the section having to do with the Washington Office for Government Relations, and that had to do with the item about the call for national dialogue to reform the nation's surveillance laws, so that the Washington office has been working on that in order to because of the fact that libraries were leaders in challenging Section 215. What I could ask, in order, because clearly that did is not enough, the Legislative Committee will be reporting back to Council, and I can ask, I'll speak with Emily Sheketoff and the group and make sure that some specific information on that is brought back to this group, because I do know that I've spoken with Emily and that they have been very busy in terms of trying to reach out. We did, for instance, on MNBC, there was a mention of libraries as part of this whole thing. So we've been trying to, we do think that the concern about this provides an opportunity to reignite the library issue, because obviously there are a lot of discussions. I think Emily said that there were something like a almost a dozen bills that have been introduced already that would place limitations on this surveillance. So we do see this as an opportunity to actually get Section 215 reopened for libraries.
Well, I'm just wondering if we could get something more specific about how much lobbying they've actually done in the Congress. That would be great.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great.
Thank you. Microphone four.
Deirdre Conkling, Counselor at Large. Just to add to what was just said, if you go to ala.org/liberty,
right,
that's where you'll find the information.
Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we'll move along. At the 1985 midwinter meeting, Council voted that the endowment trustees be invited to report to the Council at each midwinter and annual conference. I now refer you to ALA Council document 16.1 through 16.2 and call upon Kate Nevins, endowment trustee, to present the report on behalf of John Vitale, chair, who was unable to attend this conference. Kate, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to have the chance to report to you all today. You should have a copy of this report and the slides that I will be using. I will be talking about some general observations today about the economy, some specifics of our endowment, and then some announcements at the end. If you look at the general situation, the endowment group looks very carefully at what's happening in the market. And we have specified here this one. Aha, wonderful. Okay, we have specified here some of the things that we have been discussing throughout the year. And one of them is that we had a really strong start to the year, which is always a good thing when you're on a committee that is looking at finances. The first quarter was strong, but it was weaker for the second quarter, and this is sort of a traditional thing that happens in June. I didn't even know it had a name, the spring swoon. Then after that, the Federal Reserve signaled the possible end to bond purchases. And that's one of the things that has provided the liquidity so far. We've already seen interest rates go up as a result of that, and we're expecting bond values to go down as a result of that. In the first quarter, the market grew at an annual pace of 2.5%, which was strong when you compare it to the previous quarter. Cutbacks in the federal spending have, we expect, to mute the growth for the remainder of the year. And public sector spending has been declining, which is from the end of the stimulus as well as the sequester. So all of these are combined that we think it will hold down the market values for the rest of the year, which will have an impact on our endowment. The next slide turns to our endowment specifically, and this is our long-term investment fund, and you can see that as of May of this year, it achieved $34,951,042, which is a nice number to report on. These are funds, of course, which ALA uses to support scholarships, the divisions, initiatives, and general fund activities. And, of course, they are critical to supporting the mission of ALA and the impact ALA has on the world. You can see these bar graphs that show you the growth over the past several years. The return in 2013 has been 8.4%. And that is a beautiful thing. The next slide shows you how the endowment funds are allocated to different funds, each with its own manager. And we engage with different managers because they specialize in different sectors of the economy and different methodologies for investment. And this breadth and diversity gives us strength in our investments. And I'll be talking more about these different funds specifically. If you look at this slide, you'll see the equities portion of our investments and the performance of each of those year to date. In other words, for the first 5 months. And across each one, you'll see the market value of that component of our endowment, the percentage of our endowment funds, the return year to date, and the index against which we measure our performance. And this is something that the endowment trustees look at very carefully every meeting, is the performance of our various investment tools. Our total equity investment, as you see at the bottom of the page, is 74%, almost 75, of our total endowment, and it's $26 million. And this is the same information for bonds and fixed income, which total 25% of our overall investments, about $8.7 million. So we are well established in both of those. If you look at, I'm going to see if I can go back, I missed. If you look at the equities, you'll notice that our returns versus investments vary according to the fund. And some exceed the index. Some are relatively even with the index, and some run behind the index. And this is the kind of information we look at closely as we look towards the future decisions that we'll be making. And so in the equity area, you do see that diversity of returns. In the last 5 months in our fixed assets and bonds, you'll notice that we are running ahead of the indexes in all categories, which I think is pretty great. We do take a look not only at the most recent year as we evaluate, but at the longer term results. And so as you can see from this chart, for each investment vehicle, we look at 1 year results versus the benchmark, 3 year versus the benchmark, and 5 year for those we've held for 5 years. And the reason for this is we don't want to do a knee-jerk reaction to small variations in the marketplace. We need to look at it over the long term. The division among these different managers is determined by our allocation strategy, and that is established by the trustees. And here is our current asset allocation strategy. We make a decision what kinds of funds we want to be engaged with. And we continue to believe that asset allocation is the key to generating positive results. So this is very important for us. And you can see in each asset category, we set the minimum percentage that we want to have in that fund area, the maximum, and then a target. And you can see how we're tracking to those. And we are within our strategy in all areas. As we have a slowly improving economy, we believe that equities will be less risky than the bonds, and so we are moving forward and have moved forward in increasing our exposure to bond to equity holdings. The Fed's announcement about slowing down on bond purchases makes this a good move, we believe. So here's the things that we are tracking as we go forward with our investments. The first is the general economy is expected to be expanding, but slowly, unfortunately. The current recovery is likely to remain choppy throughout the summer. We don't see a smooth path there. Investors and the market, we expect to overreact to the Federal Reserve bond purchases, and in fact, we've already seen interest rates go up. Slowing economic growth in China, the collapse of the commodity prices. I noticed gold was down to $1,300 on Friday. Austerity inducing a recession in Europe, and all of these things are going to have an impact on our investment returns. We believe that the market will not go on a tear anytime soon, is how I would say that. Despite these uncertainties, we feel very confident that the portfolio is well positioned to take advantage of the financial environment, and that the changes that we will continue to make changes in the portfolio as the circumstances dictate. So that's where we stand with our investments. In addition, you will find attached to our report the analysis of the fossil fuel resolution that we were asked to analyze for BARC. We have forwarded our report to BARC, and I believe that has been made available to everyone on council as well. We hope you consider it closely as you discuss the resolution. And now a few announcements. Bob Walton, the chief executive of Claremont University Consortium, has recently announced he's changing positions, and he will go to be the vice president of finance and administration at Vassar. Congratulations to him, but that means, unfortunately, he will be resigning his seat on the endowment trustees. We do have a great addition to the endowment trustees, Siobhan Reardon, who is the president and director of the Free Library of Philadelphia. She also happens to be the chair of Lyrisys, so I'll be working for her, which is cool. So Siobhan Reardon will be joining us effectively July 2nd. She has started attending our meetings by phone as part of her orientation. And last, I would like to thank the ALA finance staff who've been assisting and supporting the endowment trustees throughout the year. I'm a new trustee this year, and I'm especially appreciative of the work they have done for us. I know I speak for all the trustees in thanking Greg Calloway, Keith Brown, and Elaine Klimek. It takes a village, and I really appreciate their work. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Kate? Microphone 2.
Thank you. Thank you for the report. Thank you all for your service to the profession. Terry Link, Michigan State University personal member. Couple of questions about the printed report that were not covered in the verbal report relating to the proposed fossil fuel resolution. In the very short part that you have on page 4, of course, it's condensed from the fuller report that's at the very back of this, but I'm a question about this $1.2 million over three-year period that would have been lost if one had done that. Mm-hmm. Even in the longer version of this, it doesn't say how it was calculated.
Mm-hmm. That was calculated in two ways. The first was by assuming that we had divested of the three funds which we currently hold that include those stocks, and if that those funds had been reinvested in clean alternative energy sources. So it was two components of that.
Okay, thank you for that. I have a couple other questions regarding the proposal. I won't go into length. I've written something much longer in terms of response to the five-page report. But even on the financial footing that you offer in that report, and I think you used the word that the risk, that you referred to report by the Imperial Group that you quote as saying, I'll open it up so I don't misquote you, that would be rude, would be relatively minor. The risk of making that transition would be relatively minor.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually go and look at the Imperial report, if you took out all of the fossil fuel holdings by that report, the portfolio risk was listed in their report as 0.01%. If you only did the fossil 15, which is referred to the worst of the worst, if you will, that was referred to in the resolution, 0.0006% portfolio risk. So the way I look at that's really minor to that. But my questions are back more to this, and they cannot really be elaborate. I'm not asking specifically for answers to this today.
Okay.
But I think this needs to be discussed by the full way that we look about our concept of financial responsibility, and that is we've limited everything to a financial lens. And so all the numbers you gave us were financial numbers. Mm-hmm. But they externalize a lot of those financial numbers onto others. So here are three questions that I have for ALA, of which I am a member. Is ALA willing to profit, even if they could, from further supporting the fossil fuel industry that is directly linked to increasing evidence of climate change? And if so, how much profit justifies that trade-off? That's question one. Number two, are ALA's investments aligned with its mission? Or do we imagine that investments only have a narrow financial bottom line, simply detached from the environmental and social costs, and one of ALA's core organizational values as listed in the strategic plan of 2011 and 2015? Third question, will ALA join the ranks of many other institutional investors with about $30 trillion committed to investment in what are called the Principles of Responsible Investment, which is a United Nations finance initiative driven by the Environment Program that I don't see ALA's name on. We need to begin to think about the cost, not just what comes back into our pocket. And I'll finish with one little quote from Joe Keefe in a recent newsletter. Joe Keefe is the president, CEO of Pax World Funds. These are his words. The flimsy rebuttal we sometimes hear that an endowment's fiduciary duty means that its only obligation is to maximize return, regardless of the consequences or externalities, is utter nonsense. There is now a substantial body of research underscoring that companies with better environmental performance also tend to enjoy better financial performance. It is ignoring these issues rather than integrating them, which most likely constitutes a breach of fiduciary duty. Thank you for considering these things as you go forward. We have a responsibility to those who come after us to align ALA's mission, environmental, social, with the way we spend our money. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And of course, the foundation trust and the endowment trustees are watching very carefully the discussion here. And I look forward to hearing the discussion over the next several days.
Microphone two. And I just want to call to the attention of the body that we have several more reports, and it's about 10 minutes to four.
Elaine Harger, a member of ALA and librarian at Washington Middle School in Seattle, Washington. I agree, $1.2 million over three years is a large sum of money. However, it only took minutes, maybe hours or a couple of days for much more money than that to wreak havoc in libraries when Hurricanes Katrina, Sandy, when Midwest tornadoes and flooded waterways hit libraries all across the country. At one time, it was very profitable in this country to have slaves, until the moral imperative and the repugnancy of slavery made that institution no longer one that is accepted as a source of profit. The fossil fuel divestment campaign right now, of which your report was focusing on, is giving individuals, universities, churches, and other institutions across the country the opportunity to recognize a new moral imperative, which is one that will, at one point in time in history, later on from now, will say that profiting from the destruction of the planet was morally repugnant. So my question is that since Council is the decision-making body of ALA, I believe that it can instruct the endowment trustees, in spite of the work that they, in spite of their recommendation against divestment, that Council can instruct the endowment trustees to go ahead with fossil fuel divestment, despite the potential losses, so that it will be in keeping with our values as an institution that recognizes its social responsibilities. And I just want to be sure that I am correct in that understanding.
I am not an expert on the ins and outs of ALA, but my understanding is that Council advised, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, Council advises BARC, which advises the board.
which is the decision-making body in this case. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
At the 1987 midwinter meeting, the ALA Council voted that BARC, the ALA Budget Analysis and Review Committee, should report to Council at each ALA midwinter and annual conference. I now refer you to ALA Council Document 33.1 and call upon Clara N. Borer, Chair of BARC, to present her report, and here she is.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Budget and Analysis Review Committee, I'm pleased to provide our report this afternoon, which includes an update on the FY13 budget that's going to focus on year-end projections and actions, a council referral, and other BARC activities and actions that have taken place since the midwinter meeting. Let's start with the budget update, reviewing results through May 31st, which is 9 months into our fiscal year. You can see that for total ALA, both revenues and expenditures are both less than budget. The general fund revenues and expenditures are also less than budget. But since there's a projected deficit in the general fund, I'm going to come back to that in more detail. Now, from the division perspective, revenues are more than budget and expenses less than budget. As a group, our divisions are in a strong financial position with a net asset balance as a collective group exceeding $12 million. They have been proactively managing expenses to meet the changing patterns of their revenue. Roundtables are also in good financial shape. As a group, they have a net asset balance of $1.2 million. Our grants revenue currently exceeds budget, and our endowment is at almost $35 million. Now back to the general fund. At midwinter, I reported that senior staff was carefully managing expenses in anticipation of a potential revenue shortfall. After midwinter, with 6 months of budget results available, a $1.9 million deficit was projected. The general fund, as you know, encompasses publishing, conferences, conference services, memberships, and the ALA offices and support units. The deficit is a result of a revenue shortfall which required significant expense reduction. This slide shows year-end revenue projected to be at $29 million, which is 8% less than what we originally budgeted. Publishing accounts for the majority of the variance at $2.4 million. Members, programs and services, which includes conferences, is projected to be very close to budget. Chicago is a great conference site for ALA, and registration numbers have been very strong. So there is potential to close some of the gap once all the revenue and expense for conference is known. Communications includes membership dues, which are projected to be 3% lower than budget due to personal memberships. The next slide looks at year-end projections for publishing. The majority of the revenue variance is the result of lower than anticipated book sales across all the imprints, followed by digital reference, which includes the RDA, and then ALA graphics. Obviously, some of this decline in revenue can be attributed to less buying power on the part of libraries due to economic conditions. In 2012, the publishing industry in general experienced a 21% decrease in professional book sales over 2011 and a 5% decline in college textbook sales. So ALA is consistent with that trend. I must also say that there may have been some overstatement. I think we may have been a little too optimistic about our potential for publishing sales. We need to have a strong fourth quarter publishing, particularly in the area of textbook sales, to meet our year-end projections. This next slide illustrates that just over 7% of expense reductions were taken across all the general fund units to reach a balanced budget of just over $29 million. It took extraordinary efforts on the part of all general fund units to reach a balanced budget. No fund balance was available this year, as in years past, to cover the deficit. So where were the reductions made? At midwinter, these were the items I discussed regarding managing our expenses. These actions, totaling just under $1 million, have helped reduce our expenses. I want to specifically point out that the staff compensation that was included in the FY13 budget has been eliminated due to the size of the revenue shortfall and the magnitude of the expense reductions necessary. You can also see we continue to operate with numerous positions in the general fund going unfilled. By September 1st, there will be 33 positions open, or about a 10% reduction. This next slide illustrates other areas in which expense reductions were taken since March, totaling $952,000. I'd like to point out that staff development funds across the association have been eliminated, and the senior management took a voluntary 10% salary cut. BARC supported the proposed actions to reduce expenditures as developed by senior management and staff, as did F&A and the executive board. Two items emerged from BARC discussions that I'd like to mention. First, if year-end results, and we may not know this until October, are more positive than projected, BARC felt strongly that compensation should receive the highest priority, the staff compensation. This is a position that is also held by F&A and the executive board. And second, the lack of revenue growth in FY13 dictates a conservative budget approach in FY14. Revenue projections need to be in line with our current economic conditions and trends. Our business plans need to be reviewed and reevaluated in order to make sure our revenue targets are realistic and attainable. It is very difficult to reduce expenses halfway through a fiscal year. This next slide sums up the general fund status. So in 2012, we had a 1.3% deficit that was covered by our net asset balance, which was nearly complete depleted. We budgeted in 2013 to replenish that by about $300,000, but the revenue shortfall made it impossible, and instead we had to make the reductions. And you can see in 2014, there will be further reductions in both revenue and expenses, and our treasurer this afternoon will report on the status of the FY14 budget. Now I want to move on to the council referral that you now see on the screen. BARC was unable to assess the financial impact because we have no responsibility for the endowment fund. We forward the request to the endowment trustees, who report directly to the executive board. The executive board serves as the final authority within the fiduciary structure of the endowment. A report was received from the endowment trustees and was forwarded to council during the first week of June. On the screen, you can see the reasons why the trustees do not support the resolution. With the information from the endowment trustees, the impact on the general fund, which is currently on the screen, was able to be calculated and was also shared with council. At this point in time, with this resolution, BARC concurs with the endowment trustees. Now on to BARC activities since midwinter. BARC recommended to the executive board approval of a proposal from membership committee to increase the retention of small and very small organizational members. We also reviewed ASCLA's business plan and then recommended to the executive board an extension of small division support for ASCLA through the FY16 fiscal year. We took similar action, you may remember, for United for Libraries at our midwinter meeting. I want to point out that the small division support, however, for both the divisions will be reduced by 50% as part of the budget cuts for the FY14 fiscal year, as recommended by management, senior management. At our spring meeting, the FY14 budget was thoroughly reviewed in light of our current circumstances, and BARC recommended to the executive board approval of the preliminary FY14 budgetary ceilings. BARC, as you know, has the responsibility to monitor the FY14 budget through the methods listed on the screen. Particular attention will be paid to general fund revenue performance. BARC members will be participating in two other meetings here at conference, the Planning and Budget Assembly, and the BARC Division Leaders Meeting, which is required by the ALA's operating agreement. I'd like to conclude my report today by thanking members of the Budget and Finance Committee for their hard work throughout the past year. I also want to thank the ALA finance staff, Greg Calloway, Keith Brown, Sandy Lee, and Elaine Klimek for their outstanding work and support in preparing the information necessary for BARC to carry out its work. Actually, the entire finance department should be recognized for their work in implementing the new accounting system, which has led to greater efficiencies for ALA. I was able today to report on using May financial results rather than the usual April results because of their efforts and the new accounting system. They've done a good job, and I thank them for that. And that's my report.
And I see that we have a question, microphone four.
Yes.
Not a question, but a comment, Madam President. Brian Schottlander, Alex Division Counselor. Claire, I commend you for your fabulous work on BARC, and also want to commend BARC, FNA, and the Executive Committee for your commitment to staff salaries being the highest priority should the association's finances allow it. We and Alex feel very strongly about the quality of the staff who support us, as I'm sure every other division in this association does as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Microphone three.
Lauren Comito, Counselor at Large. Generally, when you have to make budget cuts, it makes sense to make budget cuts, but it also makes sense to look for new sources of revenue. Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask, I'm not sure if that's within BARC's purview, but what kind of new revenues we're looking for, or how we're looking to increase revenues, and whether those 33 positions that are being held open are affecting our ability, not having those people is affecting our ability to do so.
Right. Well, I can tell you, I know Keith will want to answer some of this, but BARC is not involved in the new business development. The treasurer in his report that is going to follow me will be addressing that issue so that, and I believe I'll have Keith talk about the positions of whether they will remain open. I think they are planning to for the time being.
Recall the section of Claire's report where she talks about the fact that we had a $1.9 million shortfall that became evident 6 months into the year. We then, because of particularly conference revenue from this year to next year, are looking at another $1 million. We essentially had to close a $3 million gap in 5 months. So the fact of not giving people a salary increase, I think the severity of what we faced can't be. This is a serious situation, and I think we've managed it very well. We've managed to avoid layoffs. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do that. Obviously, we avoided furloughs as well. So we're trying to actually implement significant cuts. Now, then, to switch over to the programmatic end, I would say that at this point, we are trying to do everything we can. Staffing reductions, and again, this has been through attrition, have affected for the first time the Washington office, and they'll be impacting literally all the offices in ALA. We're working actively with the managers, and we've given the department heads great flexibility because we know that the major goal is to sustain program commitments. We have a lot of important work that needs to be done. So we have been looking, for instance, at things like, can we reduce costs by reducing printing, for instance, and going electronic. We're trying to look at ways in which we can, particularly as we move into the 14 budget, what are the things that are not absolutely essential so we can focus on the things that are absolutely essential. Now, I don't have, because we need to give managers the time to work on this, and we will be doing this over the course of the summer and even into the fall. So, for instance, in the Washington office, we had an opening that occurred, and that was in the copyright area. That's very important. So Emily worked with the Washington office staff. They put together a new team in order to sustain that effort, and clearly over the course of the coming months in the coming year, as opportunities present themselves, we've got to keep copyright, our copyright lobbying strong. So the managers are managing so that we haven't done anything like a position freeze. We've given people targets to operate within. I will say that the ALA that we knew before the recession, I'd say my comment is that ALA has a diversified revenue source, which is an enormous strength of the association. $5 million in revenues out of a $30 million budget from dues means that a lot of other revenue is supporting intellectual freedom and diversity in the Washington office. Unfortunately, we also have diversified revenue slumps. And the recession, advertising dropped by $1 million within a month at the beginning of the recession. Membership, we've really have held remarkably steady. But publishing is now, reeling. With regard to new business, and I know Jim's going to talk about this, the major opportunity continues to be in publishing, electronic publishing, and online continuing education. And I think that we have significant opportunities there. We're going to have to downsize the association so that we have to be able to operate within the revenues that are available, but this is by no means the end, and we will continue to invest. We need to get revenues back up. I think we've been working on plans to do that, which we would be happy to, discuss in little chunks or large chunks, and I think that we do have the ability going forward to go back to regrowing ALA. We may be a little different after we're done. Again, the major focus always has to be on what are the essential strategic priorities for the association, and I think we're actually in pretty good agreement on those.
Microphone 3.
Herb Biblo, member. I want to congratulate Park and ALA for their volunteer time and stuff like that, and we're all living in difficult times. But I have one question. I've always assumed that council was the policy-making body of ALA, and all other entities have to adhere to policy that is established by the council, the body here. I've been hearing some things, makes me sound like Bach and others are independent of the council. And will you assure me that council is still the policy-making body of the association?
Yes.
Yes.
And no other entity can overrule what council decides. That correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, okay. I just want to make that clear, because what I've been hearing is that other bodies seem to be overriding, or think they can override the council. Thank you for that.
We have your assurance. Microphone 4.
Yes, Stephen Stillwell, personal member. I would encourage Bark, and I was glad to hear what Keith said, to look more closely at ALA Publishing. I'm an adjunct faculty member at a library school. I cannot afford, as an adjunct member, to buy the textbooks, and I would never, in good conscience, recommend my students do it if I can't afford it. So I really think that that's an area that needs to be studied closely.
Thank you.
Microphone 2.
Melora Randy Norman, ALA member and director of Unity College Library. Unity was the first college in the United States to divest from fossil fuel and has experienced no loss from that decision. So my question for you is whether you have considered a complete divestment or a gradual, if you considered a gradual divestment strategy before you rejected this idea, as opposed to, or if you just assumed that immediate and complete divestment had to, was, you know, supposed to happen, and that was what you based your numbers on. Thanks.
I don't know if I, that's an endowment trustee question, not necessarily a question for BARC.
So let's move along because time is getting short. Microphone two.
Karen Schneider, Counselor at Large. I will keep this short because I think it's a question for another day. But I want to state it here. First of all, I agree that we need to look at publishing, and I would at some time like counsel to get an explanation of how we project what ALA actually believes the future of publishing is going to be. Thanks.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, I want to take a moment before you leave the podium, Clara. On behalf of the ALA Executive Board and the membership, I want to present you with this plaque. And I'm, given the time constraint, I'm going to just read the plaque. The American Library Association would like to express its appreciation to Clara Ann Borer for our outstanding leadership, guidance, and dedication to the ALA Budget Analysis and Review Committee, with our most heartfelt thanks for all of your good work.
Thank you.
And now I direct your attention to ALA Council Document 13.1 and call upon the man at the podium over there, James G. Neal, to present his report.
My responsibility here with the Treasurer's report at the information session is to focus on strategic issues and financial trends as they have an impact on our fiscal year 14 budget. As we constructed the fiscal year 14 budget, As we constructed the fiscal year 14 budget, we were aware of several critical meta trends, and many of those have already been referenced. Clearly, we're dealing with a set of economic challenges that affect all of us in the library community, but the association as well. We're dealing with political environments, state and federal, that are not as supportive as we want them to be of the needs of libraries. More online and distributed professional participation in the work of this association is taking place, and we need to build the capacity to address that. There is increased globalization of the information issues that we care about, and therefore we are being drawn into policy debates, not just at the national level, but at the international level as well, as evidenced by the WIPO treaty that was just approved. We're seeing, as been mentioned here, massive changes in the publishing industry, clearly more focus on digital and licensed content, the open access movement. All of these impinge on the publishing program at ALA, so the calls for us to step forward and talk about that strategically, I think, is very relevant and very important. And of course, a limited growth in the MLS workforce. These trends have raised some challenging financial issues for ALA. As been noted, our publishing, our membership, our conference, these primary revenue sources are flat or declining. Thus, we need to diversify and enhance our sources of revenue. We need to invest in technology and systems that allow us to produce essential efficiencies and productivity in the work of the association, both here and at the ALA offices. However, whatever we do, we must remain focused on member value and engagement. This is our highest priority. And keeping our resources, limited and reduced as they may be, focused on our strategic priorities will be essential. We need to look beyond our core businesses and find ways to bring in new revenue to support the work of our association. We are focusing on new products and new markets. And as we've looked at business development, these are the areas in which we have explored. The move to electronic publishing, the rapidly expanding ALA continuing education online, the wider involvement of the international community as members, as attendees, as purchasers of ALA products around the world. more directly interacting with the public and library users, and exploring, as appropriate, mergers and acquisitions that enhance our core businesses. We also recognize that the budget situation mandates that we constantly invest in new technologies and systems and allocate the funds to build new capacities for services to our members, our financial accounting system, the new web content management system, the proposed new e-commerce system, all of the various hardware and software upgrades that we are making from our capital budget, as well as from a technology reserve fund that was created by the executive board. All of these are making a very positive difference in the work of the association, the service to our members, and the productivity of our investments. So let's take a look at the fiscal year 14 budget. Here you can see the fiscal trends for the total ALA budget as we move from 2013 to 2014, with the projected reductions in revenue from publishing, $1.9 million, and in grants, $1.7 million. I'm talking at the overall ALA level. Here you can see the parallel reductions in our expense categories, particularly in the personnel area, $1.6 million in payroll, and in our various operating areas, $1.3 million in the various costs, non-personnel costs at ALA. So we are working very hard at ALA level to keep our overall revenue and expenses in balance. The general fund trends indicate that on top of the $1.9 million reduction that was reported on by Clara in fiscal year 13, we face an additional reduction of $1 million in fiscal year 14. This is the same slide that was showed to you earlier. You can see that we see a reduction in our budget in 2014 down to $28.8 million. Why do we face this situation? Primarily, we are facing a loss in revenue from publishing. Here you can see that sales are projected to be $1.9 million less, and we also are projecting an over $800,000 reduction in revenue as we move the conference, the annual conference, from Chicago to Las Vegas. These are the primary drivers in the need to extend our budget reductions in fiscal year 14 by the additional $1 million. You can see the 10-year revenue trends. We reached a peak, and we have experienced a continuing downslide in our overall revenue streams at ALA. In our expense categories, we are facing reductions in payroll, nearly $1 million, $919,000. In our publications-related expenses of $245,000, and in operating areas of $1.7 million. This is a very significant change in the expenses that we have available to us, and the funds we have available to us to operate the services and programs of this association. And here you can see the parallel expense trends over that same period of time. We have weathered the financial challenges over the last 3 years by drawing down funds from our general fund net asset balance. It is now exhausted. We had a high of $3 million in 2009, and we have spent that down through each year to deal with the deficits we experienced over that three-year period. So as reported by Clara, we have a combined fiscal year 13 and fiscal year 14 budget reduction of $2.8 million. We're holding open vacant positions, as reported, 33. There is no proposed compensation increase in the budget plan for fiscal year 14. But again, I think the overriding principle is if we experience financial results which are more positive than what we're projecting, staff compensation must have our highest priority. We're seeing some income growth from the CPI dues increase, which members have approved, $80,000, from some conference registration growth and grant overhead. And the balance has been achieved through a series of operations reductions and what I would call accounting adjustments, things that we have found in the budget in fiscal year 13 and 14 that allow us to get through as one-time adjustments in our budget. The most important trend here is to understand the revenue-producing areas. We are seeing, as we noted, a relatively flat budget situation in dues, while our publishing revenues and our conference revenues are projected to be down. Critical to understand is that these revenues support the offices of ALA and the administrative services that are provided. Divisions are generally in solid financial condition. You can see that they are proposing to have expenses of $505,000 over revenue, but also, as reported by Clara, they have net assets of $11.5 million. The roundtables are also in good shape, with projected net revenues next year of $56,000 and net assets of $1.3 million collectively. So, I will be presenting to Council for approval at our Tuesday meeting the budgetary ceilings for the work of the Association in fiscal year 14. This will come back at you with further explanation. The net result here, the most important takeaway, is that we are a reduced but still a $63 million organization doing great things for the profession, great things for libraries, and important things in support of our members. I'd be interested if you have any questions.
Are there questions for Jim? I think microphone three.
Honorable member, I thank you for all your hard work on this, and I can't, all I can, I only have one question, focus question, is how has the Neil Schulman acquisition impacted our publishing?
The Neil Schulman has been part of the ALA Editions portfolio for just a year, just over a year. We've tried to track very carefully the acquisition, the revenue over the first year. What was reported to us yesterday is that Neil Schulman revenues are actually exceeding ALA Editions revenue, which was very positive. What we're watching very carefully, because we know as we bought the company, June, July, and August were the most critical months because of the textbook use of Neil Schulman publications. So I think as we come into the fall and at midwinter, Herb, I think we'll be in a much stronger position to provide a detailed analysis of what we've experienced. I think the first year, the transitional year, was tough. I think based on the second year, we will know a lot more. But based on the numbers we're seeing now, Neil Schulman sales are exceeding ALA edition sales.
Thank you. Okay.
Microphone two.
Karen Schneider, Counselor at Large. Jim, can you advise us here or later what the how you calculate the almost $400,000 increase in publishing revenue for 2014?
Let me go to that slide because I don't want to misspeak. That's net revenue?
Yes.
Yeah, it's slide 15.
That is net revenue. There is a reduction in the overall. If you look at slide 16, where the sales are down 1.9 million, there is a significant reduction being made in publishing expenses. So the net revenue we hope will be higher as a result of those changes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, let me also say, because I know it's an area of interest of yours, we also are projecting a growth, and there was a report sent out on revenue sale projections for RDA,
yes,
and that's part of that formula as well. We're seeing a significant pickup in sales of subscriptions to RDA on a global scale.
Right.
Okay, and we're hoping that will be sustained in fiscal year 14, and more conservative publishing goals have been set for next year.
Thank you.
Microphone 4.
I have the same question.
Still microphone 4.
Tom Wilding, personal member. I was looking at the potential new revenue sources or that slide particularly included online professional development or training, or I can't remember exactly what the words were. I wondered if in looking at things like that, whether you think about the potential impact on the revenue sources for chapters, who also depend on revenue to keep themselves going and do a lot of professional development kinds of activities. And as ALA does more online, that may in fact have a negative impact on the revenue sources for chapters. And so mama starts to eat her children, and we in the chapters are worried about that, yeah. Or might worry about that.
Well, that's not a very pretty metaphor, but that's okay. I think there's a significant sensitivity to that. And I think ALA, as it built out its continuing education online, continuing education, let's call it ALA University, if you will, whether there can be a regionalization of that and partnering with the chapters, I think that's the real strategy that we need to look at. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. And I now call upon Executive Director Keith Fields, who has about 90 seconds for announcements.
And luckily, I have 0 seconds of announcements. You've heard the attendance.
Wonderful. I call for adjournment of the meeting, and we will almost immediately start the membership meeting, but you have about a minute for what I would call a stretch break.